Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
All us little human beings, we grip onto, you know, this small self identity that gives us a sense of security. But all that will be let go of as we meet death. And certainly if we let go into authentic love.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu back with Mind Rolling and back with a very special, special being, Roshi Joan Halifax. Roshi, we were just saying it's been a long time, but nice to see you.
It's so good to see you. Mm. I'm just, I'm missing Baba and missing the community, but anyway, feeling close to everybody.
Yeah. And of course, the community is really going through a lot, those of us that are in Maui. And that is a tragedy that is almost beyond comprehension. It's really something.
Yeah.
So everybody out there, first of all, because we have lots of new listeners, Roshi. Roshi is a long, long time close friend of Ram Dass and knew him in his Richard days, I believe, right?
That is the case.
Yeah, that's before my time. And
A young guy.
catching up. But Roshi was very close to Ram Dass over all these decades, really. And they did so many different things, so much work together. And I had the delight in the times that Ram Dass was in Maui, Roshi would come over and visit Ram Dass. And some of those times I was there and we managed to actually really get to know each other a lot better hanging out in Ram Dass's house, where you used to say, I came for my heart transplant every year.
Right.
In January.
Right.
Oh,
yeah,
boy.
So true. So true. And then, you know, we had such an amusing relationship. I think it was, you know, filled with affection and mischief. And, you know, I say this every time you and I do this interview thing, Raghu, I just say, you know, I'd always propose. So, you know, we really should get married, aren't you? And, yeah. You know, in our last visit, he proposed to me. And
oh,
I went,
really?
No, please spare me.
Yeah,
I tell you, what a doll, what a treasure, what a magic person. And I just, you know, we miss him.
Yeah.
And kind of like Ty says, a cloud never dies. Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, a cloud never dies. He lives with all of us, you know, in a way that is remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. But some of the fun, though, let's recount some of that fun. For me, it was when he would be sitting up there with you, and maybe I was there, maybe not. But there was always that moment of him saying something in reference to soul or soul land.
Right.
And then he'd kind of peek over at you and like,
give
I'm so sorry I've said that blasphemous comment.
I know.
And everybody would laugh. Yeah.
I know. We, you know, I mean, decades we had this conversation about soul, and I would be just, oh my Buddha. This thing of, you know, this separate entity that sort of floats out and, you know, goes to heaven kind of thing. But, you know, in one of my books, I gave a different interpretation of soul. And, you know, it really has to do with the depth of character, you know, this kind of, you know, when I used to hear Bessie Jones singing, boy, she had soul. And that's the kind of soul that, you know, I could relate to. I can never relate to the entity.
The menschy kind of part, one would say.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But isn't it true that, and this, you know, we've gone through this as well. Isn't it true that there's just a lot of different nomenclature, right?
Yeah.
Ways for people to feel comfortable, but how to, you know, talk about the ineffable. And that's, so to me, Buddha mind, soul, I don't see the difference ultimately, except for the fact, of course, but the way in which one can get firmly ensconced in a something,
yeah,
that is in this case we're talking about reincarnation, is going to go through intact with the I that we have. It's probably a problem.
There may be a problem. I, you know, I'm not a specialist in reincarnation. You know, talk with Bob Thurman. I love Bob.
Yeah, Bob.
He'll give you the full download.
Yeah.
But, you know, he would go from role to soul, and I totally can relate, you know, of this, the role. I just got off a call with two of our chaplaincy cohorts, you know, 60 fantastic people, literally from all over the world, and some of them very academically trained, where the sort of academic role is a kind of defense system, you know, where you have some kind of social merit for being such a smart person, not necessarily a wise one. But I often think of the two words that RD, you know, toward the end of our long path together when we were teaching, and he would share these two words. And they were loving awareness. Yeah. So he said, you know, he was the loving part. I'm the awareness part. But I'm not so sure about that. But anyway, I think he was both for sure.
Uh-huh.
And what he did by bringing those two terms together was really, for me, you know, what unifies all the traditions. You know, we don't have these spiritual traditions to have mean awareness, you know.
Right.
Sorry. No, thank you. And that I just think about what His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you know, would say. He said, you know, my religion is kindness. And kindness has many different expressions, and Artie manifested so many of those valences. You know, he was a genuinely kind and giving person. He was also, you know, he was a contemplative, but he was also, I mean, I think he was an extrovert and I'm an introvert. You know, I mean, how he could sit there and hug 300 people, you'd have to hospitalize me. You know, I could not bring that one off in a gazillion years. And he would just sit there, you know, and take it on. And, you know me, I'd be slipping out the back door like, oh, no. But he was just, he just was fundamental generosity. He was the king of Donna.
Yeah. Fundamental generosity. And you know Duncan Trussell, and Duncan and I have been working on a audio book, actually, from the movie of me to the movie of we. Basically, Krishnadas's coined expression, you wake up in the morning and it's you're the producer, director, lead, supporting cast, and you're the critic too.
Yeah.
You do the whole thing 24/7, you know, and how do we get there and how do we get out is part of what this thing. So the thing, the book ends, I took a little piece of Ram Dass, you reminded me, because of generosity. And in it, it was all generosity and compassion are the basically the way to transform from that me to the we. And he was so exemplary. He exemplified that.
Yeah, he did.
He really did.
Really.
Well, from the get-go, where Neem Karoli Baba said to him, don't talk about me when you go back to the West, okay? Oh. That's all he did. So the summer, I was with him the summer before he left in 2019.
Good Lordy, Miss Marty.
Yeah. I said, why? He told you not to do it. He's the guru. Why didn't you do it? Why did you go on and on about him in every talk you gave for you? And he said, I got given a jewel. I couldn't not speak to people. I could not share that jewel is exactly what he said. And that is kind of the core of everything that we to this day, since he left, are doing the best we can to represent that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, we miss him. Although every day because of the work I'm doing, he's right there. I'll pass this stuff. What do you think about, maybe I've got a little bit of self-interest going on here. You know, I used to speak to him directly that way. Day to day, you know, I'd be it's like having a therapist right there in terms of doing the right thing. Oh, God. So,
Raghu, do you remember that? I think it's the last time, it wasn't the last time I saw him, but it was the last time we taught together, where he, was in the hospital and Frank and I showed up.
Day before,
and he was in the ICU. Then he got discharged to, his regular little room, and then he came home and so on. And he had terrible edema. I was like, oh, my God. And Frank and I had this whole plan of, okay, we'll go ahead with the program without him, and got the whole plan worked out. And then Friday evening, he just perks up like a prairie dog, pokes his head out of the hole of his sickness. And says, let's go. And I'm all going, oh, Buddha, my Lord. And we went. And I'll never forget, it was raining cats and dogs. The church was completely packed out. And, we went in and, his team of bodhisattva helpers lifted the wheelchair and that big swollen body onto a stage, and it was like a 2-hour darshan without any words.
Wow.
It was so incredible.
I think we have a video of it, yeah. I don't think we've ever shared it.
I was like, wow.
How?
And Frank and I are kind of talkers. We were just like, we were in the mood. Not to talk, but to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. And that's what he offered. So much after his stroke, especially in Maui, that being in the spaciousness of his silence, was really quite well. This is a little bit of an ode to Ram Dass because Roshi and I haven't really gotten together. It's been a while, so it was due.
It was due.
It was due.
It is due.
Yeah.
I'm up here at the refuge, you know.
You are?
It's technically not in a, you know, very 9,400 feet surrounded by 3 million acres of national forest. It really suits me here in my, you know, sort of hermit-like nature. Wow. There's nobody near. And, you know, I'm with the aspens and the great evergreens of northern New Mexico and practicing and feeling, you know, the great blessing of this place. But because we have Starlink, thank you, Elon Musk, okay.
Yeah, I noticed because you would never do this with me before because you couldn't get reception.
It was such lousy internet. I am so with Maui at this time. I tell you, Raghu, some of our friends, I just heard that they're okay. They survived. You know, who knows how many are lost in the history being just burned to ashes.
Yeah.
And of course, the great banyan tree in Lahaina probably survived.
Really? Because it seems what I've read is sort of questionable.
One hopes.
Yeah. Okay.
The roots are so deep and the fire didn't penetrate.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is a time of mourning, and it is a time when we're in a climate catastrophe. And I just finished a series with Cristiana Figueres, who was the architect of the Paris Climate Accord and a great climate diplomat, and Rebecca Solnit, who is the writer and social critic, and she's on top of everything, brilliant. So the three of us did a 10-part series on, meeting the climate future. It was very intense and interesting, in the middle of which then this fire comes roaring into this sacred place that has been kind of secularized in a certain way and commodified, you know, in the past decades. And just wiped everything out, the history and all of the art. It's just like, and it's a sign of the times. And of course, it's not the only place that's under siege. And, you know, there's so many.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, such a wake-up call in this era.
Yeah.
You know, it's not to be doomeristic because we don't know the outcome, but we can change the course of this. Not entirely, because the momentum of problems, the tipping points have been crossed, but we can change this for future generations.
Yeah.
And I often say, Raghu, I feel like I was born for this time.
Mm. Oh, yes, I've heard you say
that. You know?
Yeah. I think we need to fix ourselves. We really do, all of us, need to fix that thing in us. I mean, that is part of the problem, unconsciously part of the problem, in terms of the smallest kinds of things and the way we live. And we live in a feeling like we're separate. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
Is this just illusion of a separate self that is just completely nuts?
Yeah. No,
you know, you realize you're not separate from the very air that we are breathing. We're not separate from the trees that are producing oxygen. We're not separate from any being or thing. And, you know, I think we're getting the picture, but in a weird sort of way. I think the pandemic was this enormous wake-up call in terms of cause and effect, karmic conditions, and the globalization of a virus where, you know, millions of people lost their lives, and where the politics associated with those countries who were in charge of, you know, vaccines and so on, just making it a real case in point that we have to share. We have to practice Dana. We have to practice fundamental generosity. We can't hoard and think that we'll just survive being in the top 1% or 10%.
Yeah,
whether it's vaccines or money or what.
Yeah,
of course, I'm an anti-capitalist. So.
Yeah, right. But still, that's all being written living technicolor now.
Yeah.
And people can no longer think that we're okay in this separate place here or there, and there's not going to be an effect on us. All of that kind of thinking, I think, is the beginning of its diminishing. And I look forward to the next generation, you know, the 20-year-olds that are really caring and acting around, of course, you know, the ecological disaster that we're in. So, yeah. So, wait a minute. We have to do a commercial from our sponsor, which today is Roshi Joan Halifax.
Oh,
look at this fantastic thing.
I
can't believe I love the brush painting that's in here. It's just phenomenal. It's a contemplative card deck. And you can open it up and just pick any card. And that can be your intention and contemplation for the day. Oh, here's the one I picked. All right. Connecting with the earth. How about that? Sitting comfortably. So they're really cool, very short meditation. Sitting comfortably, let your attention rest lightly on your breath and your body. Now sense into your connection with the earth. Invite the stability of the earth into your body, your heart, and your mind. Experience the strength of your connection with the earth. I did not plan that. I swear I just picked that out. Okay? So this is a wonderful deck, everybody, and it's available. We'll have it in the show notes.
Oh, show it again.
Okay.
It makes me happy to see it.
Isn't it? It's beautifully done by Shambhala, the publisher. It's really, really wonderful.
You know, Raghu, when I moved up here to the refuge during the pandemic because we were in complete lockdown at UPaya, and I just picked up the calligraphy brush and I did literally thousands of calligraphies. And it was, you know, a practice for me. Mm. And also because of, you know, being able to be online, I interacted with people from all over the world who were really, you know, they were in isolation too. And I realized that it was important for many people to have access to these micro meditations. It's like micro dosing practice.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, over a few years, I would just write out these short meditations and then Shambhala produced them. It's a wonderful object, actually, they produced with, I mean, it's so beautifully done. I'm kind of like, wow, that was really nice.
Yeah, really beautiful. In fact, I think we'll try and we'll get to order some from Shambhala and put them in Ram Dass's store because.
That'd be great. I'd love you to do that.
Yeah, we will.
I mean, actually, it's gone really well. People love this practice. You know, they're using them in all kinds of different ways, including, you know, in hospitals where, you know, nurses will actually pull a card and then lead, you know, in a team meeting, a micro meditation.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
And I'll be doing that in Japan in September with people. So I just.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's really, really.
Did you ever record them? I hate to get into it. Like,
you know, I didn't. And I actually thought about doing it, but I've been, you know, with the chaplaincy training and everything else going on, I haven't had time to do it.
Mm.
Maybe I'll do it.
Yeah, we'll help you in any way, whatever you want. You know, we have an app now. The Ram Dass Be Here Now app has a microdose. Little snippets of Ram Dass either saying something, a video of him, or a text, and microdose with Ram Dass, it's called. So this would fit in so perfectly. Oh, boy. So just in talking about all, you know, the kind of suffering that is going on, particularly in Maui, and everybody, whenever this podcast comes out, or if you listen to it at a later time, this is right in the middle of it. I mean, it's a week old at this point, a week and a day or two. What's going on there. And so, you know, I look back, actually, Roshi, into a book of yours that I really love, Being with Dying, that book.
Yeah.
And just let me read something. You can, like, comment on it. As someone who works with dying people, I used to feel a little apologetic about being Buddhist, concerned that my practice might seem sectarian and inappropriate. But over the years, I've seen how much the teachings of the Buddha have helped the living and the dying of every faith, and my reservations have dissolved. It's crucial that we Westerners discover a vision of death that valorizes life. The encounter between East and West has unwrapped the gifts of love and death, and now we can see that they are two sides of the coin of life. Talk about love and death and being the two sides of the coin of life, because it creates a fearful atmosphere even to hear that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, there's a quote that's attributed to Rilke. I don't know if it, in fact, is Rilke's words, but I heard it many, many years ago, and then I've shared it many, many times. Now it's attributed to Rilke, but I haven't found the source. Maybe someone can. And the quote goes, "Love and death are the great gifts that are given to us. Mostly, they are passed on unopened."
I just saw it and it said Rilke, okay, from wherever I got it from. So yeah.
Yeah. I'm afraid I might be responsible for that misattribution, but nonetheless, it's one of those things that has been, you know, I think it was R.D.'s path. It's certainly my beloved Frank Ostasevsky, with whom I teach so often myself, the relationship between love and death. And it really is about surrender. It's completely about letting go into the vastness. It's about being fundamentally uncontrived, not separate in this experience of boundlessness. And we grip, you know, in the West, but, you know, all us little human beings, we grip onto, you know, this small self identity that gives us a sense of security, but all that will be let go of as we meet death. And certainly if we let go into authentic love. And I just, this book was written really inspired by those words, whoever, you know, uttered them. Great blessing. But it also is about a path, you know, a path where love and death, as I said, are two sides of the same coin of life. And, you know, Plato wrote that the bedrock of the spiritual life, he didn't say it was love, he said it was the contemplation of our mortality, which is, I think, you know, when we come to the realization of fundamental impermanence, which is exactly what the Stoics and what the Buddha taught, the truth of impermanence, of uncertainty, of the changeability of everything, unpredictable. You know, we think that, you know, we're, the brain is this predictive organ. We're, you know, ChatGPT, you know, and these large language models, we're back into this sort of predictive mode. And life ain't like that. Reality is not like that. And I think we're in a completely phenomenal era where, for example, the discussions around AI are challenging our view of what is true. And, you can build this kind of constructed pseudo-reality, what's called, you know, the AI process. Someone used the term stochastic parroting. But also parody. That's another way to put it. Yeah. And you realize that actually our very perceptions are constructed, just as AI is constructed out of our views and our values and our misapprehensions. So, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Wisdom in, hopefully, sometimes wisdom out, who knows?
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that Bernie Glassman, who R.D. loved, and Bernie sure loved R.D.
Yeah.
He really, Bernie, who was a really smart guy, He valued not knowing. You know, he really,
I love that. I always love that.
You know, our social merit is based on how much we know. Yeah. Hey, excuse me. Actually, all of that knowingness separates us and each other from who we really are.
Yeah.
So, you know, this practice of not knowing, and in the koan it says not knowing. Well, the whole thing is useless. Of the three bodies of the Buddha, monk asked this great Zen master, which one does not fall into categories? And the master said, well, I'm always intimate with it. You know, it's a direct connection with just this moment, the present moment, as it is.
Yeah. Be here now.
Exactly. Mm.
So something else, you know, in relation to what we're just discussing now, love and death, and related to the suffering, which is endemic everywhere, but particularly, of course, what happened. And everybody out there, we have been doing retreats with Ram Dass till he left 4 years ago in December, in about maybe a 10 to 15 minute drive from Lahaina, where this wildfire just burned the town down, further west, I believe. And it did not get affected, but we are so, I mean, I don't have to be in Maui to get that visceral vibration, you know, from what's happening there. So anyhow, so just so you know, in terms of timeline, we're kind of in it, you know, at this point. But here's something else that you talked about in the book. All too often, our so-called strength comes from fear. Not love. Instead of having a strong back, many of us have a defended front, shielding a weak spine. In other words, we walk around brittle and defensive, trying to conceal our lack of confidence. If we strengthen our backs, metaphorically speaking, and develop a spine that's flexible but sturdy, then we can risk having a front that's soft and open, representing choiceless compassion. The place in your body where these two meet, strong back and soft front, is the brave, tender ground in which to root our caring deeply when we begin the process of being with dying. And I always mention this because there's practice involved here. I mean, you talk in the book a lot, and I want you to talk more about mindfulness and the importance of it, and not the ubiquitous term that allows stockbrokers to, you know, make better trades, which happens as well. But just the reality that you don't wait until you're, you know, in your 70s or something to start doing the practice of connecting with that love and death, right? Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah, that is so important, Raghu. You know, in sitting with dying people for so many years and having people say, you know, give me the mindfulness pills so I can have a conscious dying and death. It's like, no, it doesn't exactly work that way. Usually, you know, it's a lifetime endeavor. And yet there are people who have not done one jot of practice who just have it. They just
go right in it.
They're right in it. And there are people who've just, you know, been grinding away at the Dharma and just lose it. So, you know, it's not the magic formula, but by any means. But I know our good friend Wes Nisker, who just recently died, and his ex-wife is in our community and saw him just a few days before he slipped away. And, you know, his whole life in a certain way was practice. And it showed up even as he lost his, you know, normal cognitive capacity, but moved into another kind of state of being. And that being was, you know, surrender. And also joy. So, you know, it really comes in, you know, in knowing Wes to the extent that I did, not in any way close to, you know, my relationship with Ram Dass, but, how he was a dedicated practitioner, and he had this sort of metacognitive perspective that allowed him to, you know, brilliantly cause us to just laugh hysterically in a liberating way at the absurdity of our human stupidity.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He has a gift.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Do not take yourself too seriously was what we got from Wes.
Yeah.
Nisker, I knew him way back on the radio because he was on the radio in the late 60s, early 70s, where I was as well. Cutting through, can you talk a little bit about, because mindfulness practice is not just about, it is very much about preparation, because any moment, anything can happen to anyone, as is just proven in Maui, especially with what's going on on our earth. But mindfulness on a day-to-day basis, just being, having the kind of awareness of one's motivations and self-interest, isn't that a big part of the efficacy here that we're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love Johnny. And Johnny took, really from the Anapanasati Sutta, these practices that allow one to come into be here now.
John Kabat-Zinn, right?
Yeah, John Kabat-Zinn. And I think that the benefit that has been derived from the secularization of this classical practice is really great. Also, there have been, issues, like there are issues with everything, including, the devotional practices that RD was so much a part of. Every stick is two ends. But, being mindful, it really has to do with, giving dana, giving your attention to whatever is present in any given moment, be it beautiful or terrible or boring, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, whatever it is. But Bernie talked about it in terms of bearing witness, not separating ourselves, and also being non-judgmental. And so, yes, mindfulness has been co-opted and kind of applied in ways that it's like, oh dear, well, that certainly is interesting.
Yeah, right.
Okay, but I'm not going to get into that so much. There are many Dharma doors, and even the ones that are more extractive and co-opting, commodifying, people who engage in these practices for the wrong motivation there is potential for great benefit and also harm, but also benefit. So, I'm interested in how we bring this further into the world, particularly emphasizing the dimension of integrity and ethics. This is, about building character and rehumanization and opening up the what RD was so clear about, the path of love.
Mm, yeah. Another element, there's a story, and I may have heard about this story, but I don't remember. And you tell it in great detail. It's the time of the Buddha, and there was a monk named Tissa. Do you remember this?
Yeah,
story? Now you wrote this book a long time ago, so I don't expect you to.
No, I remember the story.
Yeah, can you tell the story?
No, you tell it.
He fell sick, and his body broke out in terrible pustules. They gradually became bigger and bigger and finally burst. But he did not heal. Instead, open sores covered his entire body, and the stench from the infection filled his tiny room. And I don't think there's anyone out there that hasn't, if you've had, elderly parents or grandparents or something, eventually something happens. It could be as simple as, a person needs to wear a diaper, and there is a smell that is, you know, our natural inclinations would go like that, you know, inside ourselves, if not outside. Anyhow, Buddha, he visited the monastery, he heard about Tissa, and he heard he'd been abandoned by fellow monks who were repulsed by the sight and smell of his sick body. And when Buddha came to his Tissa's hut, he opened the door and saw him lying in filth, his stinking robe sticking to the oozing sores. Ugh. The Buddha turned to his cousin Ananda, his principal attendant, and said, "Please boil some water over fire and prepare an herbal bath." So the Buddha gently washed these sores on his body while Ananda washed his clothes. And they put him in a clean bed, and Buddha lifted him, put him down, and held his head and gave him fresh water to drink. And Tissa opened his eyes to the Buddha and said, "If you had not helped me, I would have died," the sick monk said. The Buddha then spent some time with him, teaching him. Shortly after his careful tending, Tissa died, free in mind and body. But the exemplative story of the kind of caring one human being to another. I mean, yes, he was the Buddha, but this is our higher self, not?
Yes. Yeah, it's such a powerful story. You know, it's about coming alongside. It's about selflessness. And it's also, you know, he, in a way, he was saying to his monks, look, you have neglected this being, your brother monk. And because you've not been able to face the truth of old age, sickness, and death. And that when you take care of Tissa, you take care of me. And I think it's a, you know, really... such a powerful example of what it means to care. And, you know, you don't think of the Buddha being a caregiver, you know, in this sense. But, of course, I had to include it in the book because it's such a vivid story of selflessness and of love.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know, I think I don't have the right term, and maybe you do. His Holiness the Dalai Lama recently was talking about selfish. I don't think it's compassion, but
it's selfish compassion.
It is.
And I remember I did this series of meditations for a Dan Harris program with Ram Dass. With Dalai Lama, Richie Davidson, and myself. And Dan was interviewing me, and he said, "Well, now, what do you think of selfish compassion?" And I was like, "Oh, wow. That's a term that's a little hard for me to deal with, but I can kind of dig it. In other words, really, you know, compassion benefits those who receive it. It inspires those who witness it. It inspires them to be compassionate. So it's kind of viral. But also there's so much evidence that compassion benefits those who actualize it." And I've done, you know, a lot of writing on this, including in my last book, Standing at the Edge.
I
opened this whole sort of treasure house of compassion. So, you know, I could understand the term, but it could be, you know, also misapplied. And I was like, "Oh, well, that's kind of interesting, but I can dig it, you know, that, and it makes sense." And it's kind of, you know, kind of gets your attention, and it's very Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I loved it because, I mean, take it in a much more simple sense, shall we say. You're walking across the street. And you get to the other side, but before you get there, somebody starts to walk, maybe an elderly person, and they fall.
Yeah.
Or they drop some groceries. So your instant, I would say for
response.
Most of us, instant response is to go help them. And as soon as you do that, you are not thinking about yourself.
Yeah.
In that moment, in that entire sequence.
Yeah.
You are gone. It's like, you know, I often say... when I first met Ram Dass, he set up a zone, shall we say. There was no Richard, there was no Ram Dass. It was what how can I serve you? You know, he was able to do that, and he did that for his entire life, especially after the stroke and he was in Maui. But it's that impulse creates a situation where you are no longer this self-interested, you know, moment-to-moment being.
Right.
That selfish compassion. I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very catchy phrase.
yeah, really.
And you know, it's true. So it's Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you in the book, you talk about the vow of the Bodhisattva, and it can be a skillful strategy helping us to move away from our self-centeredness. Yeah. Similar kind of a thing.
Exactly.
Right? No,
that's the deal. And, you know, the Mahayana tradition is, you know, in part this brilliant construction of deconstruction of the small self. You know, whether you're cultivating bodhicitta at the beginning of practice, really stepping into, you know, a motivation that is fundamentally, you know, boundless and caring, or dedicating the merit at the end of the practice, or acknowledging the past and expressing loving appreciation for the ancestors, as we do with Ram Dass, or taking care of the children in the future, and so on. So, you know, and it's all about other. And ultimately, it's not about other as separate from self. It's about self and other being non-separate. And, you know, it's this non-dual realization that is so powerful for us to directly experience.
Yeah. When you say that, I remember a moment we were in Maui. We were doing a podcast a long time. I think it was with Duncan. And I asked you, look, you've been around Ram Dass forever. So you keep seeing his guru, our guru, Neem Karoli Baba. What do you think about him? I said this to you. And you said, you stopped for a while and you said, when I look in his eyes, I see empty. That's what I see. And I said, yeah, in fact, you know, Ram Dass, in a thing that he did with you and Frank also many years ago, he talked about, somebody asked him what he thought of, you know, to say something about his guru. And he just went off and he just kept going. He was so empty. So, you know, there was a real tie together that way. And then you jived me after that moment and said, you know, eventually you'll have to give up this duality thing that
you're doing. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, Raghu.
And I said? I said, I understand that intellectually, and, you know, I'm sure it'll occur in some billion of, but you're like way ahead, okay, Roshi? You're way ahead.
No, not really. I can tell you. I'm a naughty girl.
Oh.
I tell you, I come off the rails every day. My feet of clay are big.
You know? Oh, God. Yeah. It gives us all an opportunity to go, okay, as Jack Kornfield, I love to hear, he has this little phrase, it's okay to be human, he says.
Yeah.
So
Raghu, since I'm human, and I've actually been online since 9 a.m.
I know,
morning,
you've done this.
I am going to say, oh, my Buddha, thank you, my darling.
Well, do one thing, though. I do want people to know about what you have been doing here with the chaplaincy. Can you just briefly say what the chaplaincy is and how people can be in touch with it?
Well, yeah, I think many of you know, Upaya Zen Center is a socially engaged Buddhist center where we train clinicians and chaplains, among other things. We feed the unsheltered and work in the prison system and work in the Himalayas in delivering healthcare to people in these very remote areas.
Mm.
And the training program we're in right now, that's why I've been online all day with just this phenomenal group of people from all over the world, about 60 people in the training program, is a 2-year, very intensive training program in Buddhist chaplaincy. And our director, Mary Remington, is head of a big chaplaincy department of a big hospital in New York. And she is such a bodhisattva. Oh my God, she's in the work. up to her eyeballs. And the result has been, Raghu, that the program now has gone on for about 15 years. And UPI's trained chaplains are all over the world. Blown away by the placements and the work that these men and women are doing. Yeah. And the program itself, the training program itself, involves a very intensive experience of spiritual formation, because we recognize this path of chaplaincy truly as a sacred path. And yet it's not sappy, if you know what I'm saying.
People, no, not at all. I actually know one of your people who's close to me. Is actually on part of Love Serve Remember. And she, oh, yes, I'll be up at 5 this morning. I mean.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, terrific. It's a great training program. And also the clinician training program, Being with Dying, is really amazing. And the Grace training program in Compassion is just an extraordinary process. So yeah. I love what UPAYA does in the thread of ongoing practice. The contemplative thread is really essential to what we do, in addition to this, you know, the very rigorous science-based content that we transmit in training programs.
Yeah, it's so great. So there'll be links so you can go to upaya.org, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And we'll have all of that. Oh, wait, you can't go. I got to read one thing because can't forget.
Okay.
Look, this comes from Fire. The four elements comprise the deck, meeting the boundless heart. And this I did pick out, although it completely is connected to everything we've been talking about. It's called On Unselfishness. Recall that all beings and things are interconnected, including friend and enemy, forest and city, you and the air you breathe. On your next breath, consider the futility of self-centeredness. Feel this in your body. Next, bring someone to mind and heart whom you wish to be free of suffering. Let your wish for this person help strengthen your aspiration to serve others. As you experience fully how this feels in your body, breathe deeply into your belly, vowed to do whatever you can to end suffering for all beings. What a beautiful thing. Can I read a couple of these things and... We're doing a course with Alan Watts and Ram Dass, by the way.
Oh, great.
So I
listen, they're out there. Just use them in every way.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Everybody, this is great to see Roshi. This is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. We shall see you next week. And again, thank you so much.